Hello, everyone. How are we? Mani-ai. My name is Dominic Guerrera. I'm a Ngunnawal and Kaurna person. And I know that we've already had a welcome to country this morning and at the beginning of the festival that's played every day. So as a Kaurna person, I just want to acknowledge my elders, my ancestors, the spirit of this country. And I also just want to speak to this particular spot, because just over the road was and still is a sacred site. And there was giant boulders there that was a men's site for Kaurna men. And the early colonists blew them up and used the rocks as well as digging out these hills here to take out clay and rock to build the church down the road, as well as the wall here around Governor's House, as well as other colonial infrastructure. So it's important that we remember these histories and that we know these histories, because our stories are being constantly rewritten over by the colony of South Australia. And we are a sharp reminder that the fantasy or the fairy tale of the colony is not true. And that this is Kaurna Yatta. So, thank you. I want to introduce the other three people with me today on the panel, starting with my we're here today to talk about our beautiful anthology, The Rocks Remain, which was printed through Wakeful Press. And my co-editor is Karen Wild, who's a Mudi woman, who's also a writer and artist. Brad Darkson, who's a Naranga man, who's a visual artist and a writer as well. And the incredible and newly longlisted Stella Prize poet and visual artist, Ali Kobe Ekerman, who's a Yankandada woman as well. I'm going to hand over to Karen now.
Okay, thanks, Dominic. As a Māori person born and living on Kaurna Yatta, I'd also like to acknowledge that I'm on Kaurna Yatta, and I pay my respects to Kaurna elders past and present. I also express solidarity with Palestinian people and ask that you all think of the Palestinian poets, writers and journalists who have been murdered and even assassinated by the apartheid state of Israel, not only in the past 5 months, but the past 75 years. I also show respect for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander writers who are being attacked due to their solidarity and friendships with Palestinians. Mm.
And I just want to particularly name Evelyn Arulin over at Overland and Amy Maguire, who are two very public and outspoken Aboriginal supporters of Palestine who have been publicly attacked, and they don't deserve it because they're standing up against genocide. But before we jump in, I just want to tell you the story of how this anthology came to be. And it's very important because it weave so many of the networks that we are a part of. And so Karen and I were attending the First Nation Aboriginal Writers Network for Norn here at Tandanya, the National Summit. And Karen approached Michael Boland from Wakefield Press, and then we started talking about, you know, why isn't there an, you know, Karen's always great at creating the spark. And was saying to Michael, why haven't you done an anthology? We need to do an anthology. And he said, well, do you want to edit it? And I was sitting on the other side of the Tandanya Cafe minding my business, and I hear my name called out and Karen going, Dominic, come over here. And so I came over, and within 5 seconds, I had been told that I was co-editing this beautiful anthology with Karen. And then we applied for some funding from Creative Australia, and we were fortunate to win that. So we want to thank Creative Australia for that funding, because it allowed us to do a really comprehensive call out and also pay our writers, you know, a lot more than what a normal anthology would be able to pay them. And it's about, you know, respecting artists as writers. So then we had the beautiful pleasure of sifting through all these works and providing a lot of writers this new opportunity to not just be published but also go through, you know, a editing process that they hadn't been through before. So not only was it new for me as an editor of an anthology which I had never done before, but we're able to echo that through for the writers as well who featured in this. The cover is featuring the work of Ghana artist James Tyler, and the title comes from one of Brad's lines in his work, The Rocks Remain. And we kind of didn't actually talk about the title or the cover for a long time, and we just kind of were reading Brad's piece together, and we looked up at each other when I read that line out loud, and we kind of were just, we knew that this was the title, and everything just fell into line. And so in that, one of the big themes that came through was country, as it does in a lot of Aboriginal writing. And so for Brad, I want to ask you about your piece that you contributed to this anthology, because it is intrinsically tied to your visual artwork. But that work is speaking to a particular part of, you know, country, like Ghana country. And I just wanted to ask you, can you tell us about your relationship to that land and how you established that, and then how that kind of speaks to you as a visual and writing artist?
Yep. Thanks, Dominic. And Karen, for the huge amount of work that you both put into this. I was in the car getting a lift with my sister, and on the way in she was telling me, you know, this is 20 years in the making, really. And so you've done such a great job bringing it all together and working with Wakefield to produce something really, like, that's a huge milestone for community. Also, acknowledge Ali for being up on stage with us. I only just got a copy of the anthology in my hands when we were on the way to the stage, so I was quickly trying to read yours, and I didn't get through the whole thing, but I look forward to reading the rest of it. So first, I'll just acknowledge as well that we're meeting here on Ghana Yarra, and pay my respects to Ghana elders past and present. And in particular, I wanted to mention one particular elder, Aunty Lynette Crocker, who worked with me on the exhibition that I wrote this artist statement for. And the exhibition is just about to start its first leg of a three-year tour. So it was over at ACCA. It was Between Waves, Yalingua exhibition curated by Jess Clark. And I was one of several artists in that group exhibition, and it's about to start that tour in Hobart. So Aunty Lynette is someone that I've worked with on multiple projects. She's incredible, one of the best storytellers, like a lot of our elders, and she's just got so much knowledge and respect for country and community and the arts, and is one of our most staunch activists, especially for Ghana culture. So when I approached her to start talking about the work that I made for Between Waves, the work's title is Waiting for Kikira, the Ghana word for moon, she and I got to talking about, you know, a few ideas I had for producing a work that was responding to country, responding to a site that highlighted people being intrinsically connected to a site, to that country and to the waters. We started talking about fish traps, and she directed me to a place down south called Kongaratinga, which we kind of now refer to as Warina Cove. And there's a site there, there's a few sites down there, and one in particular that was destroyed during the development of a marina there, which is an old Ghana fish trap. So we started talking about that, and I think just to kind of keep things brief so that we can all talk a bit more, because I could talk about this a lot, she's incredible to work with. She was planning on coming down to Congaratinga with me, and we were going to bring community and family down and check out the location of where the fish trap was. And she, like a lot of our community and elders in particular, has to dedicate a large chunk of her life to going to dialysis each week. And so she's got some health issues as well. So underlying health conditions meant that she couldn't actually make it on the day and she had to go to hospital. So we kind of changed the whole day around. And it was, it was a little bit disappointing for me. It was mainly really disappointing for her. But I still went down there and the day was incredible. It was a beautiful sunny day. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to send her some images and footage from the location, from Congaratinga, where this river winds down and meets the ocean. And I'm just going to try and give her as much from this day as possible. So I did that, and then, kind of we worked on the work from there.
Your turn, Karen.
Okay, thanks, Fred. Ali, firstly, congratulations for your book, She Is the Earth, being longlisted for the Stella Prize. Your verse novel features your relationship with country. Can you tell us how country influenced your work?
Thanks, Karen. The reality of She Is the Earth started on Boonwurrung country on the Mornington Peninsula. And I had a visit from an old spirit who planted a seed. And I knew it was stronger than a dream. And I carried that for a little while. I also want to then bring it back to South Australia and acknowledge Kaurna Yurta, where I was born. And recently I've realised this is the place where my placenta and umbilical cord was destroyed. And I always have strong feelings when I am here. My brother, Carl Winder Telfer, when he learnt that I was born on his country, has always been a support for me to sometimes unravel those feelings. But often as a young Kanjara person who met my mother at 34, and my journey often leaves me to live in a quite solo way, often there aren't Aboriginal people around, and I do spend a lot of time listening because my traditional women in Central Desert taught me how to listen and the importance of it. And slowly through that isolation and a period of deep sorrow, the book started to emerge. And for me, it's different. It's not a book that I can read readily because it's very deep. It's very soulful. It's a plea for women who are challenged in the beliefs. We mentioned the word fantasy and fable before. You know, I thought by the time I was a grandmother and reached this age that I would get that bit of an Enid Blyton ending and that the world was going to be a really kind place and my family would be centred around me and I could be proud to be an Australian and would televised bombing of women and children who were stuck behind gates wouldn't be a reality. And I think That's only how I can answer the question about shears the earth, because it's a plea for hope. If everything is stripped away that you know, then there is poetry, there is culture, and there is listening.
And I... You and I have been... And you and I, because we work together, we have this conversation about listening to country. And I really feel like you have opened up that to me, for me, in a lot of ways, like that inner ear, I guess. And how that then informs your writing, you know what I mean? And it's not like because the poem or the work is... How do I describe it? It's beyond words in some ways, but like that the story is there, but you've got to listen to the story and it's got to also be speaking to you at the same time.
Yeah, country talks. And ancestors' spirit voice isn't limited by native title boundaries. Mm. And, you know, Ruby Moonlight was listening. Mm. It was written with a, you know, in collaboration with a river. The benefit of being back on country that knew me as a little girl and as a teenager and native title, it's not my traditional country. I've been blessed to have spent a lot of time in the desert, but I'm back there on Ngadjeri country. I pay respects to Ngadjeri people. There's a solace there too. Mm. And there's a solace of staying put. Most of my life I was running around looking for, you know, a piece of myself, my belonging place. And the journey keeps bringing me back there. And so when COVID hit, it was so lovely to go back there to that empty house and slowly rebuild. And, I'm writing a lot. It's not a secret, I don't think. New and selected collection coming out in August. I think there's something too about arriving to your final chapter, and I say that with pride, not with anything negative. There's something that happens in our bodies when we reach another level of maturity. And sometimes if the future's a little bit uncertain, I think you find a lot of solace in the past. Mm. And probably in reverse of that too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's almost like country holds, even if it's not our country, but we grew up there, it holds our stories there as well, like our childhood stories.
Yeah, and I can spend 4 days a week just totally me and the dog. That's a lot of solitude. That's a lot of being in the moment. That's a lot of listening. I'm very influenced by listening and watching and
Karen, you contributed something that's a bit out of the norm for you for this anthology.
Yeah.
You're known as a short story and novelist, and you've now started... I remember when I first met you, you were like, I don't write poetry, and now you're starting to write poetry and putting it out there, which I really love. Can you talk a little bit about that branch, It Hums, which is your poem, and how... Because it's about your writing process... Mm. But it's also how country is actually embedded in your writing process as well.
Yes, yeah. So last year, this is a bit of a lead-in. After meeting Susan Abuhawa here at the festival, she invited me and Ali over to Philadelphia to speak at Palestine Rights. And this is Susan's personal scarf as well. She's just been asked to leave Gaza. She crossed over through the Rafah border a couple of weeks ago to take aid and run story writing workshops with displaced Palestinians in Gaza. So she's just left 2 days ago and currently in Cairo trying to get back into Gaza. So I just want to bring her into this space because she is a writer that puts her body on the line, not just her words. So before, I thought, this is really nice, I'm going over to speak in America, but I felt that I needed to go and spend some time on country before going. I thought that was very important. You know, we've just come out of COVID and all that sort of stuff, and it's like, no, I cannot go overseas unless I've spent some time on country. So I put in for a Newman Sydney travel grant, which I got to go to Philadelphia, but also to spend 3 weeks driving around in a camper van in WA, sleeping on the side of the road and near dry creek beds and all sorts of places. You know, it was great. I didn't stay in hotels. Who needs them? And so I spent that time going. I did a hike down to Moore River Aboriginal Settlement and walked around there for a day. I spent a day at Nova Scotia. All these sites of violence I went and researched and spent time in as part of research of the novel that I've almost finished writing and also some new works. One day I was a little bit lost. I love getting lost. I was looking for a ghost town, but instead I found the Rabbit Proof Fence, which I walked along, and then I spent the night at a camel soak, which was just magic. So I found some really incredible places on that 3 weeks, but I did spend about a week on country, and the day after I'd gone up and visited my grandmother's grave at Chigalong, I was leaving Newman, and a poem popped into my head about writing processes and about connections to country and story. And then I slept in this amazing place that night. It was just amazing. And then that next morning, my poem for Red Room got published, my first ever published poem. And so I stopped my camper van on the way to Port Hedland and wrote another poem, which is in this book.
Listening.
So it's about my process of writing for sure, like, here in Adelaide, I do daily walks in the scrub and the wetlands and on the beach, and that is my writing process. Like, if I can't get out into nature, I can't write. And so being up on country was also part of my writing process, so I've now got a whole lot of work I've got to do. So I was driving away from my country, and that poem just came to me about how both places influence story and how I'm a storyteller. Like, it was just, wow, I'm a storyteller. Yeah.
Before we jump into the next question, I just want to acknowledge some of the writers from the anthology in the audience, including Natalie Harkin, Noah, Sonia, and Jada.
And please stand.
Please stand. And if there's other writers as well that I've missed, could you please stand up?
Oh,
Stephen.
Yeah, Noah.
Over here.
Oh, who's up the back there? Rick?
Yes.
Is that you?
Hi, Rick. Rick from Kangaroo Island. Stephen Pappin as well. Michael Larkin down the back here.
Oh, Michael. Hi.
And it's one thing that Karen and I are carrying with this is that this is not our anthology as the editors, but it's our anthology as all the writers who contributed to this. And that this opportunity needs to be shared amongst all of us.
I want to say, as a grandmother, anthologies are really, really exciting because it brings for me an introduction to new and emerging writers that I haven't had the chance to meet. And I really hope tonight that it becomes a level playing field, you know. Please include me and forget about the Stella, and like, let's all be lateral and in our celebration of this, because sometimes the whiteness of those prizes can isolate a writer, and we are all Aboriginal writers, and please, let's build an equal campfire tonight.
Yes. Thank you. So before I ask my question, I also want to say that of the 25 writers in the anthology, 19 of them are South Australian. it is very difficult for South Australian writers, especially Aboriginal writers, to get their work out there. So this is mammoth. It's just fantastic. Most have never been published before.
Woohoo.
It's their first time. There's a few emerging and there's a couple of established writers. So really encourage you to get the book. The other thing too is that me and Dominic will be growling at anyone that calls it our book in their interviews or reviews. It is not our book. It is all 25 writers' books. So my question to Dominic, you've contributed your most known poem for this anthology. Can you tell us more about your poem, Unwelcome to Country?
Yeah. It actually was born here at Adelaide Writers' Week about 5 years ago. I was asked by a poet called Lani Yook to do a Welcome to Country, and I had stopped doing Welcome to Countries because I was just very fed up with the disrespect to elders who were constantly giving culture, constantly giving welcome, but yet, and calling for significant change, but nothing was happening. So I, excuse my language, but I was like, well, fuck you all, and you're not going to be welcomed anymore. And so I, you know, my frustration often writes the best poetry, or my anger, and, well, my poetry. and I wanted to write a poem that spoke to what I think was the abuse of, towards elders and towards the expectation of being welcomed without doing any work towards Aboriginal rights. You know, so it's one thing to be welcomed, it's another thing to actually, for people to be doing work after. So often I would say to people, you've been welcomed, now what? And so I wanted to highlight in the poem the kind of hypocrisy in, particularly in Adelaide at festival season, where, you know, I don't believe in two worlds, and I write that in the poem because I just believe we live in a colonized state. But that colonized state allows a significant number of this population here in SA to live without thinking about the impacts that your lives are having on our lives and our culture and our country. And that's what I'm calling for in this poem, is for people to, that once, you know, the nice way to engage with Aboriginal people gets removed, and you have to be confronted with the truths of what we're actually living with on a daily basis, a lot of you don't want to engage anymore, you know? And so that's why I'm asking, is for you to actually start confronting those truths in this poem. And so it's kind of fitting, it's full circle that I waited a long time to publish it. I won a prize and all this stuff. And I think that it's really fitting that it sits in this collection amongst all these other local writers, and that we're now back here launching it here at Adelaide Writers' Week, where that poem was born in a way, or was written for. And it's had many iterations, as good poems do. But I remember when I first read it, I actually read it again the next year, and Ali and Mandy Brown and a few others, and Natalie were in the audience because we all read together, and Stephen as well. And afterwards, I felt like the response from these respected writers that I love was very positive, and I felt like they see me as a poet. And it was the strength of that poem. So I'm glad that I have saved it for this anthology and that it gets to sit amongst this. But yeah. Other themes in this anthology included themes of like protests, resistance, and relationships, which I think are very common themes in a lot of Aboriginal storytelling and art. And one of the things that I always love to do is acknowledge the people who, you know, Ali and Karen and Natalie here and Ali Baker, who have come before me and, you know, not just opened doors but shattered them, kicked them down, because there shouldn't be a door to there in the first place. So I wanted to ask everyone on the panel, who are people that Aboriginal people who, Aboriginal artists and storytellers who you have admired, who have been transformative or have maintained Aboriginal storytelling? Who wants to go first?
Who don't you mention in that? Yeah. There's so many. There's so many amazing people.
But personally for you, in your work, who has impacted that?
I've had the privilege of working with a lot of artists, installing their work in many galleries around the country over many years. And I think for me, you know, growing up, listening to like strong women in community talking about family and history and culture, and you know, first, like, I've got to acknowledge my sister Natalie Harkin, who's, you know, in here and in many other books, and is so incredible and has worked with so many other incredible people, like Ali sitting next to her and Julie Goff and Faye Blanche from the Unbound Collective, Simone Tur, you know, these storytellers that, like, that really, like Dominic says, are, you know, breaking down barriers for people in community to do great things, to educate. It's hard to kind of narrow it down. Storytellers, when I think about storytellers, I think about elders like Uncle Lewis. Mm-hmm. You know, who will tell you a story, and you will be sitting there listening to that story for about 40 plus minutes, you know, and it'll be like 50 different stories in one. Mm. And Julie Goss kind of similar in that way, you know, like we'll sit down and you'll talk to her and Nat's smiling because she's been there many times. It's like, you know, like Aunty Lynette's the same. Like so many elders in community, you just got to give them the time because they've got so many amazing stories to tell. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter if you're calling up for, you know, because you have a question around one thing in particular, you know, you might never get to that and you might be on the phone for an hour and a half, but you've listened to so many different stories. I think about people like that. Trevor Nichols' artwork was like just incredible to install at Tandanya back in the early days of working there for me. You know, Alex Apodi's prints, incredible from up Torres Strait Way. You know, these Ricky Maynard from down Tasmania, you know, like just amazing photography, black and white photography. I mean, John Mundine's work within communities around the Top End and in over on the East Coast. Like, there's... I don't know where to stop with that list. It's just so... Like, there's just so many amazing people and so many of them are in this anthology. Yes.
And outside of the cities and outside of the institutions that were established for white people, for me, the strength of story is in the desert. It was in the desert that I ran to when I was 17, not knowing that 17 years later I would find out that that was my mother's birthplace. Wow, what a story. And then the women in the central deserts, when I went had a commission for as a photographer from Towndie College to go out to the APY lands for the first time. And no one speaks about my grandmother because she vanished. She's a missing. And it was only out there that the oldest people recognised my face. And so began the story, like they started stitching sentences inside me. They started stitching me to my belonging place on my grandmother's country in a way that I couldn't have foreseen. The strength of that storytelling is what influences me to the core. I can't mention their names, and there's no need. They're gone now. But the love that they showed me was the one that built the atoms of my blood together to flow through my brains, veins and brains, and has blessed me with an incredible journey that is not mine. That's why I detract a little bit from fanfare, because it was them. Without them, I am nothing, and still in culture, I'm a child. They taught me how to read country, so it's a wonderful book, because wherever I go, I can see a glimpse of story, even if I don't ever learn the true story. I know that story is there, and I love that my brother, Gijiba, is living back out in the mid-north with me, the two adopted, stolen kids from Brinkworth Area School. And we went for a drive the other day to country that we hadn't known, but we both... He's had a similar journey. We both could see stories in country, and that was the thing that directed our... You know, that's where we took the car, just on the fact that over there in that long, long distance, there's a story. So exciting. I like, too, that yesterday I was with a friend who knew me at 22 in Alice Springs. We were both pretty broken young women, damaged by our loss of motherhood, I think. We went to the biennial, had the absolute privilege of being invited to participate in the biennial this year. And we watched as people hurried past my photographs, hurried past my story, and she was like, interesting. And it's like, and then I got to understand the curatorship, because not everyone can see and not everyone will sit. And it's only when you sit that you can see, and it's only when you see that you can hear. So I'm really happy that so many people are rushing past, because I know the ones that sit have been guided by something strong and valuable.
I love that.
You can go next.
I was going to say before, we are going to start taking questions, and then Karen and I will give our answers. So if you have any questions, just come to the centre. And if they could be questions, not stories, they're all in here. That would be great. Thank you.
Yeah. We joked about bringing scorecards, whether it was a bad question or a good question.
I mean, like, my people, like my grandmother, Margaret Brosnahan, who sadly has passed away now, she stood just over 5 foot and had the mouth of a sailor. You remember, Christine? And she started an Aboriginal writers' poetry writing group in her back shed at Welland. And the group was called Yunnanpulgi, which means talking house and or place of talking. And I just remember being like a kid in that space in the shed and having these poets, I don't even remember who they were now because I was so young, that they were just sitting around sharing their work. And so poetry was always like in our lives as children, because Nana was this poet. She was published at a time when a lot of other, we weren't, you know, it wasn't like now where there's a lot of Aboriginal people getting published. There wasn't that many Aboriginal people being published. And so for her to have her collection out, Raukan, which was published through Magabala, was this very significant, not just for her and the family, but for the wider community, because it created created a pathway, as well as other Aboriginal writers at that time. But also for me, a lot of the Aboriginal queer storytellers just blow me away. Like people like Destiny Deacon, whose work, you know, I am doing a master's in gender studies, so there is a bit of bias with a work like Destiny Deacon, but through photography, she's able to just capture moments using dolls and childhood. And I think of like Ghana Naranga man Jacob Boehm, who just put together Gurinder that, you know, was performed here at the Adelaide Festival, that just, yes, please, blew my mind. I was like beaming, and I'm not even Naranga, but I had this sense of pride that was just in that room and watching this performance. And that story is not even queer. It's Naranga creation stories. But to see a queer Naranga Ghana artist create that with community, not just by himself, that just speaks the volume of what we as queer Aboriginal people contribute to our culture and to our communities. And yes, it was really powerful to see that. But yeah. Karen, who are your people?
Okay. I want to give a shout out to Guri Lebanese writer and literature scholar, Dr. Michaela Saunders. She's currently under attack by mainstream media for programming a really, really beautiful session for the upcoming Melbourne Writers Festival, where she's combining Palestinian and Aboriginal writers in solidarity reading poetry. So I really want to give a shout out to her, but also just the way that she supports new writers, like, and is breaking through with Indigenous speculative fiction. She's probably is the leading Aboriginal speculative fiction writer in Australia at the moment. So big shout out for Michaela. Her first spec fic collection has just been released. It's called Always Will Be.
Always was.
Do get a copy. Also, I want to mention my auntie Doris Pilkington, whose semi-biographical trilogy shone a light on stolen generation, domestic servitude, and other policies of harm that has caused great harm to Aboriginal people. And also to acknowledge that she became a published writer in her 50s, and in those days that was quite common. Like, we're now seeing a lot of young, exciting writers, but even, say, 10 years ago, most writers were in their 50s and 60s, even older, because of the barriers that they had to break through. And she inspired me as well, because my first novel was published 3 weeks before I turned 50. I decided, well, it's never too late, you know, just do it. And acknowledge my mother, like, you know, she's one of those people just love yarning. And you know, when you're young, you sort of have a little snoop in your parents' drawers and things. Like, everyone's done, haven't they? And I remember I used to find notebooks full of poetry and short story that she'd written, but never went anywhere other than her, you know, her drawer in her bedroom. And I think that's sad. And I think I'm really excited that people are now writing younger and they're not just sitting on their dreams like that. I also want to acknowledge the silent stories of matriarchs in my family. These stories are found when reading archives of violence. And when you sit and read these archives, these stories come out. And they're difficult stories, but we all need to read these stories and we need to interpret these stories for all of you to read, and for you all to practice truth listening.
Yeah. We've got some questions.
We have.
First one off the bat.
Yes, thank you. Would each one of you please, please, please read one of your poems or recite them? I'd really like to hear.
We don't have time.
Brad and Ali have short stories in the collection, and Karen has a poem. Do you want to read your poem, Karen?
But there's other people lining up for questions, and we only have 10 minutes before we're off stage.
Well, we'll get to the questions, and then if we have time at the end, we'll read a poem. Yep.
Hi, okay. My name's Nicola. Thank you for representing all the poets in the anthology. And my question is, what in particular do you think it is that makes poetry attractive to Indigenous writers, and why are they so good at it?
Because we don't have the time to write novels. No, I'm joking. We do have the time.
Because First Nation language is poetry.
Yeah.
And we've been forced to speak English. And then when we get to learn how to listen or find our way with family or without family to that listening, it's only poetry. This country is poetry. This sacred, unceded country is poetry.
Mm. Yep. Do you want to say anything?
I feel like I'm an imposter on this panel, to be honest. I guess, yeah, like, to echo what you've just said, Ali, you know, we've got oral traditions that are linked intrinsically to country. And when you think about, like, when I'm talking to people like elders in community and I'm trying to, you know, get some cultural guidance, seek knowledge for something that I'm doing in my life that I want to take forward and pass on to the next generation, you know, everything's centred around people being a part of country. And so when people are a part of country and there's those oral traditions and, like you say, country is poetry, you know, I think that there's that kind of, like, aspect that, you know, helps, I guess. I've been exposed to a lot of, like, creative writing from people in my family. But, yeah, I'm totally an imposter. I like, when they asked me to come up here, I was like, you know, or to be in the anthology, I was like, what are you going to use? I haven't written anything, you know, like... So, yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
But your artist, just the thing is, Brad, your artist statement is poetry, the way you wrote that.
Yes.
And that's the thing about this anthology, is that we wanted to encourage people to think beyond Western ideas of what is poetry, what is short story or microfiction, mm-hmm. and to just find the poetry wherever it comes.
Yeah.
And yours really blew us away because it was something different. And I think because it was linked to that visual media, art as well. And the other thing about why Aboriginal people connect with poetry is because, and both of you have touched on it a little bit, is that we told our stories through songs. And song and lyric is another form of poetry as well, I believe. So it's just a continuation. Everything in Aboriginal culture today is a continuation of what was in the past, and it's a continuation of the future as well. And that is the same for our storytelling, and that's why poetry is so connected.
Mm.
Yeah.
I want to add to that if you read novels, a lot of novels by Aboriginal writers, there's poetry within that too. I mean, probably not some of the new YA and spec fic, but a lot of the other novels are also poetic. And Brad is not an imposter.
No.
like you inspired the cover title.
Yeah.
But if you look at when you get a copy of the book, and you must get a copy of the book in the book tent, buy a couple of copies because this is first print run, and pretty sure this first print run will probably be gone in another week, so you want to get a copy soon. So anyway, if you look at the book, we've opened with Brad's prose, and we've closed with Sister Nat's prose. And both of them are so poetic. They might be prose, but they're really poetic.
Cool.
I just think your work is beautiful. Thanks.
Take?
Dominic. my question is to everybody. I'm a non-Aboriginal poet. I'm of Scottish and Irish descent, and I'm very involved with local poetry in Adelaide, especially amongst the younger generation. And my question is, how can poets of non-Aboriginal backgrounds, and that's very diverse these days, how can we respectfully engage with these themes of anti-colonialism and opposition to Australian nationalism, have a lot of similar critiques to yourself, but from a very different non-Aboriginal perspective at times. Is there ways that could be done wrong or in a way that's not respectful or not in fair play? And are there any times where that's been done right, where someone from a background such as myself has decried what's wrong with colonialism and you found yourself agreeing with it or thinking that's a good perspective? So speak to that any way you want. Thank you.
You go.
Me, okay. As long as you're not telling the Aboriginal story or the Aboriginal experience, and if you're critiquing colonialism from a privileged point of view, then I think that's fine. but it's not about replicating or trying to tell, replicating the Aboriginal experience. Because we do need everyone through storytelling and through activism and writing to be collectively speaking out against these atrocities and things, the evils of the world. But also, I think that you need to sit and do a lot deeper thinking than just putting pen to paper. And I also don't think you can write those things until you've put some of those things you want to write about into action. So if you're wanting to talk about decolonizing or anti-capitalism or, anti-genocidal, you have to be a part of that. Those actions have to be embedded in your life before you can actually write about them as well. Otherwise you're just kind of being a bit of an anthropologist researching from with a gaze in, as opposed to doing that work. Does that make sense? Yeah. What else does everyone else think?
I think until you have sobbed your hardest on this country and sobbed ego out of your body, you can't reach that place.
Yeah. Ali puts it much better than I do.
I think working with community is a really good starting point for a lot of people as well. Approach community and talk to elders and try and funnel money to those people, because people are always expected in community, especially elders, to give culture, like Dominic's already mentioned, to perform culture and welcomes and to allow people and enable and legitimise people being here, and they're expected to share that, and they're also expected to carry that on to the next generation, and we're all expected to learn that and then carry it on to the next generation after that, but nobody will pay us to do it. So it's about funneling money to those people so that they can practice culture, and if you want to be an ally and be a part of that journey, then approaching community and I think engaging with community in a meaningful way where you're not extracting money, but you're actually trying to funnel money to elders so that they can, bring you along on that journey. Like, there's more help. Great.
Yeah. A good example of that, a friend of mine is in the audience. He brought his mates, there were 75 and 79. They drove from Mansfield in Victoria. They came and donated their time for 5 days and chucked some money towards materials and helped me renovating my house. That's the sort of income exchange that means a lot and actually produces really solid outcomes. Mm. So when we say investing can be in many ways.
Absolutely. We've now reached the end of our panel.
We have 3 minutes.
Okay, do you want me to read a poem?
Read Jada's.
I'm not going to read someone else's poem. Oh, that's not right. Unless Jada would like to come up and read their poem, not to put them on the spot. Come on, Jada.
Come on.
You got 3 minutes.
I've got a really short filler Pauline Hanson poem.
Yay!
Thank you. Sit down.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to stand over here. We can all
hear you. I'm nervous. The title is called "You Cut Off My Native Tongue and Here I Am Sewing It Back On." Slightly bruised, a mouthful of stitches, my words soften in hopes that the tongue you cut off regains, reclaims, and heals. For when speaking my tongue, now reborn, shall these words I speak cut you deep. I do have a language translation in Wirrungal, but also before reading it, I got a lot of help by Celeste over at the mobile language team. So if it wasn't for her, this translation wouldn't be here, I guess. Slightly ngandan, air stitches muga, ngajuwanga jula, in hopes that the jarling nubali janigada regains, reclaims, and heals. Ngajuwanga wangarn, idabirna, naladaga wanga, ngajuwanganda, nubali, ganiara, jagao. Thank you for that.
That concludes our panel. I just want to say both Karen and Ali's books are available in the book tent, not just the anthology. And there's also a plethora of other Aboriginal writers in there, including Gary Lonsborough, Ellen Van Nieuwen, Melissa Lukashenko,
Michaela
Saunders, everyone, Evelyn Arulan, Jazz Money. Please buy and read and share Aboriginal stories. Alexis. Right, hello.
Melissa. Did you say Melissa?
Yeah, Melissa, yeah. And we're also going to be going over there to sign copies. So if the other writers that are here want to join us to sign, yes, please do. That would be lovely. Thank you very much. Nakanda.